So, what if the secret to becoming an absolute champion, whether you know you're stepping into a boxing ring or walking into a high-stakes corporate boardroom, is realizing that everything you currently think you know is, well, a massive liability?
Right, which is completely counter to how we're usually taught to think.
Exactly. We always hear about building on our existing strengths,
yeah.
Right? Like, find your personal style, nurture your quirks, surround yourself with people who validate you.
Yeah, the whole positive reinforcement model.
Yes, but today, we are taking a deep dive into a methodology that just aggressively rejects that comforting notion. It basically suggests that your current foundation is so fundamentally flawed that to reach the absolute pinnacle of human performance, you have to demolish it completely.
It is a deeply, deeply counterintuitive premise. I mean, we spend our entire lives trying to protect our egos,
right? Oh, sure.
So to willingly walk into a space and say, you know, tear all of this down, that just goes against our basic psychological survival instincts.
It really does.
Mm.
But that brings us to the core of what we're looking at today. We are exploring the legendary training framework of Koos D'Amato.
The mastermind.
The absolute mastermind. The boxing coach who literally built heavyweight world champions from the ground up, obviously. Most famously, Mike Tyson.
Right. And specifically, we're zooming in on Chapter 9 of the source material today.
Yes, the model of self-perfection and learning. Okay, let's unpack this, because our mission today is to decode this very strange, almost paradoxical mathematical equation that is essentially the blueprint for this whole model.
Yeah, it looks like basic kindergarten math on the surface. The formula is literally just 2 + 3 = 5.
Right, 2 + 3 = 5. Like, okay, profound, right?
But as we get into it, you'll see it is actually this profound psychological and technological map. This is the exact sequence responsible for creating these seemingly invincible fighting machines.
Okay, well, let's just jump right into the first variable of this equation, the 2. In this system, the 2 represents the foundational relationship between the mentor and the student.
Yeah, and the logic for starting with 2 people rather than just 1 is straightforward enough. Like, an individual acting entirely alone simply cannot see their own blind spots. You need that outside observer.
But the fascinating part to me is how this initial phase is described.
Yeah.
It is not framed as a, you know, supportive, nurturing partnership. The source material explicitly frames it as a duel.
A duel. Yeah, and that is just the perfect word to capture the psychological reality here. Think about what happens when a highly ambitious, maybe naturally talented student first arrives to learn from a master.
They think they already know everything.
Exactly. They naturally resist instruction. Their ego is incredibly loud at that stage.
Right. The internal monologue is essentially, I'm a unique individual. I have my own style, my own life experiences. Like, why should I let you completely overwrite my psychology?
Yeah. And even if the student intellectually knows the coach is a genius, deep down, the human ego is always going to fight for its own survival. It will push back, disagree, and try to, you know, modify the teachings to make them more comfortable.
So the coach literally has to go to war with the student's ego. They have to prove absolute authority right out of the gate.
Because if that total unquestioned authority isn't established immediately, the advanced skills they try to teach later on will literally just bounce off the student's mind. They won't take root.
There is this incredible story from the text about Koos D'Amato in his old age that just perfectly illustrates what this duel looks like in practice.
Oh, the Rocky Balboa story.
Yes. So this tough, deeply disrespectful street kid named Rocky Balboa comes swaggering into the gym. And he's throwing these wild punches, acting entirely on street instinct, just treating the gym like his personal playground.
Right. And Koos, who is an elderly man at this point, let's remember, he actually puts on boxing gloves and steps into the ring with this kid.
Which is wild. And he doesn't step in to have a friendly spar either.
No, he steps in to systematically dismantle Rocky's entire worldview. He's making a philosophical point.
And the crazy part is, Rocky is swinging wildly, relying on raw street toughness, right? Koos doesn't even try to match that chaotic energy. He just bobs, weaves, and throws the exact same straight right hand to Rocky's nose and temple over and over again.
Just completely humiliating him, basically.
Yeah, to completely shatter the kid's ego, Koos literally tells him exactly what punch is coming and then just hits him with it anyway.
Wow.
He leaves this tough street kid with a bloody nose to prove a massive, undeniable difference. He shows him the street is not the ring.
Exactly. In the street, you might run into weak, untrained opponents, so that sloppy aggression works. But at the championship level, there are no weak opponents. Your raw instinct is useless.
Right, and there's another incredible example of this dynamic, but it doesn't even involve throwing a single punch.
Right, the army mug. So imagine a student sitting across from a master, feeling a bit arrogant, maybe secretly questioning if the master truly has the physical capability to back up all their big philosophy.
Like, sure, you can talk, but can you actually fight?
Exactly. And without a single word being spoken, the mentor picks up this thick, heavy metal army mug from the table and just casually crushes it in one hand.
Oh, man.
Just casually.
Yeah.
The student watches the metal warp and collapse under sheer grip strength and instantly realizes, oh, if he grabs my arm like that, my bones will snap.
It's a completely wordless demonstration of absolute terrifying superiority. It just shatters the student's delusions of grandeur.
Instantly.
Okay, but I have to stop you here because my modern sensibilities are just screaming right now.
I bet.
Wait, so the logic is basically let the coach kill your ego in the gym so the opponent doesn't literally kill you in the ring. It's like inoculating yourself with a live virus to build immunity.
That's actually a very good analogy.
But my issue is, how is this not just cult-like submission? To anyone listening to this right now, it sounds an awful lot like demanding blind obedience to a guru. Mm-hmm. Like the mentor is just a bully breaking someone's spirit for fun.
And that is a totally valid concern. In fact, it's the exact reason why most people fail to ever reach the elite level. They interpret the destruction of their ego as a personal attack rather than a structural necessity.
Okay, but how is it a necessity?
Well, look at the mechanism of what's actually happening. This two-stage, this duel, it's a safety lock against future catastrophic failures. Mm. Because this duel happens in a highly controlled environment.
Right, the gym.
Yes. By losing to the coach's superior logic and skill in the safety of the gym, the student is forced into the realization that they actually know nothing.
Which opens them up to finally learn.
Exactly. Think about the alternative. If the student stubbornly holds onto their ego, refuses to submit, and defeats the coach by packing their bags and quitting, they haven't won a victory.
No, they've just quit.
Right. They will simply take that flawed, fragile ego out into the real world and get absolutely dismantled by a real opponent. And out there, the consequences are brutal and permanent. You either surrender your ego to the mentor or you surrender your consciousness to the enemy.
Wow. Okay, that actually makes a terrifying amount of sense. You have to lose the safe fight in order to survive the real fight.
Precisely.
But that immediately brings up a monumental problem for anyone trying to apply this. If I'm going to surrender absolute authority, give up my ego, and let someone completely rewire my brain, I need to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that they aren't just a charismatic sociopath.
Yeah, you don't want to hand your mind over to a fraud.
Exactly. How do you ensure you aren't submitting to a fraud? Fortunately, the source methodology outlines three strict, uncompromising criteria for selecting a true mentor.
And these criteria are the only thing that separates a high-performance system from a dangerous cult. Criterion number one is that the mentor must absolutely practice what they preach in all areas of life.
Right. So consider a boxing coach who promises to mold you into a disciplined, focused world champion. But the second that coach leaves the gym, you see him constantly complaining about his terrible home life, his lack of money, and how miserable he is.
That is a fundamental deception. The logic here is ruthless. If this person lacks the structural discipline to manage his own life and his own family, it is physically impossible for him to marry yours.
He can't forge you into a champion if he isn't one himself. There can be zero hypocrisy. Okay, what about criterion number two?
Criterion number two is scientific reasoning. A true mentor does not operate on personal opinions, gut feelings, or, you know, mystical advice.
Oh, trust me, bro, energy.
Exactly. They must operate on hard evidence, physics, biomechanics, logical models. When a student inevitably asks, why are we doing this drill, or for what exact purpose are we changing my footwork, the mentor must be able to answer simply, immediately, and scientifically.
So if the answer is ever, because I said so, or because that's how I used to do it back in my day, you were dealing with an amateur, not a master.
100%.
And the third criterion is personal achievements. A true mentor must possess a verifiable track record of their own undeniable achievements.
Because without that, they're merely a consultant. They might offer some decent theoretical advice, but they are absolutely not a master you should surrender your entire psychology to.
But out of all of this, the most counterintuitive part of finding a mentor is the warning about popularity. In our normal lives, you and I are completely wired to seek out nice, friendly mentors.
Oh, completely.
We look for the 5-star reviews on LinkedIn. We want the person who makes us feel good. But this framework explicitly tells us to be deeply suspicious of the popular guy.
It does, and it raises a really profound question about the nature of support versus the nature of progress. True masters are strong, fiercely result-oriented, and often actively hated by the establishment.
Right. Customoto was largely despised by the mainstream boxing association for years.
Because the logic is incredibly heavy here. If everyone loves you, it usually means you have never beaten anyone. If there are no losers in your wake, there are no real victories either.
Wow. If a coach's primary psychological goal is to be liked by you, they will never have the stomach to push you to the breaking point required for absolute greatness.
Exactly. The people who constantly praise us without reason are just cultivating our fear and weakness.
Okay, let's look at where we are. The two, in our formula, this grueling, ego-breaking duel, it establishes the mindset. It clears away the delusions. You are a blank slate.
Right.
But a blank slate doesn't dodge a left hook. A psychologically broken down student doesn't automatically know how to close a massive corporate merger. How does this blank slate actually acquire the complex tactical skills needed to win?
That is the perfect question, and it brings us to the three in our mathematical formula. We have the two, the mentor-student relationship. Now we add the three, which represents the technological system.
And what is that exactly?
It's the triad of the coach, the assistant, and the boxer. In our primary historical example, this triad was Customoto as the coach, Kevin Rooney as the assistant, and Mike Tyson as the boxer.
Okay, but how does this triad actually work mechanically? Like, why do you need three people? If the coach and the boxer already have this deep ego-shattering connection we just talked about, why add an assistant into the mix?
Because the sheer intensity of building a champion would destroy a two-person dynamic over time. Think of the coach Cus as the high-level architect.
Okay.
He is the philosopher sitting above the fray, seeing the entire board, designing the strategy and the psychological warfare. The boxer Tyson is the raw physical material, the hardware.
Right. And if the master architect had to get down in the dirt and deal directly with the exhausting, frustrating, minute-by-minute friction of correcting every single misplaced foot or dropped hand.
The emotional friction would completely burn out the relationship. The philosophical weight of the master would crush the student on a daily basis.
To me, this stage sounds less like traditional sports training and more like a software boot sequence.
Mm-hmm.
The coach is the elite programmer writing the complex code.
I love that analogy.
And the assistant is the compiler, right? Translating that high-level code into machine language. And the boxer is the hardware executing the program. If the hardware tries to argue with the code, the entire system crashes.
That is a brilliant way to frame it. The assistant acts as the essential buffer and enforcer. Kevin Rooney's job was to take Kiesa's high-level philosophy and enforce it through hours of grueling, repetitive, physical drilling.
It sounds exhausting.
It is. The text describes this phase as moving a heavy weight up a steep mountain. The internal conflict inside the student reaches its absolute peak here. It is an endless, agonizing battle between the student's will to succeed and their human desire to rest, to complain, or, you know, to just take a day off.
And the strict mechanical requirement of the three stage is that this conflict is actively managed by the team. And the will must always, without exception, conquer the desire.
Always.
It's like riding a bicycle up an incredibly steep mountain. The moment you stop pedaling, you don't just get to stay in place, catch your breath, and enjoy the view. Gravity immediately takes over, and you swoop rapidly backward down the hill.
Exactly. You lose all your momentum.
The moment you stop pushing forward with your will, you lose your progress. You lose your championship status.
And what the coach assistant boxer triad really creates is an intensely controlled environment. It acts as an impenetrable shield around the student. The fighter is completely isolated from outside distractions.
Yeah, I read that Kes would often isolate his fighters for months on end in a house in upstate New York. He wouldn't even tell them if certain family events were happening, if he felt it would distract them.
Which sounds harsh, but inside this perfectly controlled bubble, the fighter doesn't have to waste a single ounce of mental energy thinking about life logistics, paying bills, or social drama.
They are forced to focus entirely, obsessively, on the pure mechanics of victory and the flawless execution of their skills.
Right.
Okay, so the two breaks the ego and builds the psychological foundation. The three provides the relentless, isolating machinery to translate that psychology into world-class physical skills.
But 2 + 3 = 5.
Right. And here's my issue. If you have the perfect master architect writing the code, the perfect enforcer running the drills, and you are putting in the hours inside the bubble, shouldn't that be enough? Why do we even need the five?
Because relying solely on the coach and the gym environment, no matter how perfect they are, is still too slow. The gym is a bubble, and eventually the bubble bursts.
Ah, okay.
To truly accelerate your growth, to become genuinely unstoppable, you have to reach the final part of the equation, the five. The five represents independent effort.
Meaning you do it on your own.
Exactly. It is the crucial realization that a mentor and a system can only take you to the threshold. The five is the individual's internal drive to take this entire methodology and transform it from a training program into a total, all-consuming lifestyle.
Because a coach can hand you a profound book.
Right.
They can sit down and passionately discuss the concepts with you, but they cannot physically read the words for you.
No, they can't.
They cannot force your brain to process the information when you were alone in your room at midnight. You have to cultivate the thirst to teach yourself when absolutely no one is watching.
Exactly. This stage requires a radical restructuring of how you exist in the world. A massive component of the five is the active eradication of your vices.
Now, wait, let's clarify that. Because in this high-performance framework, a vice isn't defined as a biblical sin or some moral failing, right?
Right. It's not about being a good or bad person. A vice is defined purely as any habit, trait, or emotional reflex that acts as an obstacle to achieving your specific results.
Let's break that down because it sounds a bit abstract.
Mm-hmm.
What does an opponent exploiting a vice actually look like? It's not just about someone finding out you drink too much, right?
Not at all. Let's say your vice is a short temper and a desperate need to feel respected. In a normal environment, that's just a personality flaw. Annoying, but whatever. But in a high-stakes environment, let's say a critical corporate negotiation, that vice is a glaring vulnerability. If the opposing negotiator discovers that you tie your ego to being the smartest person in the room, they will purposefully insult your intelligence.
Oh, they'll bait you.
Exactly. They will bait you. And because you haven't eradicated that vice, you will lose your temper, abandon your strategic logic, and make an irrational, aggressive offer just to prove a point. You lose the deal because they weaponized your own psychology against you.
Wow. And in the boxing ring, if your vice is, say, a predictable rhythm when you get tired, your opponent will time that rhythm and knock you out. You must eradicate these flaws because your opponents will study you relentlessly to find them.
They absolutely will. It is a completely ruthless, pragmatic view of self-improvement.
And to achieve this, the workload required is just staggering. You don't train 5 days a week and take the weekend off to grab brunch. You train 7 days a week.
Yeah, there are no off days.
If you aren't physically in the gym, hitting the heavy bag, then you are training philosophically. You are analyzing film, studying the psychology of your opponents, or reading history. You are constantly switching from physical to mental to tactical training, never actually stopping.
Mike Tyson himself noted that adopting this style leaves absolutely no space for a normal life outside of your discipline. You cannot live two lives.
That is intense.
That is the ultimate price of the five. You cannot be a normal relaxer person on the weekends and a ruthless fighting machine on weekdays. You must become the machine permanently.
Which brings us to the ultimate question for you, listening to this right now. Does applying this framework mean you have to abandon your entire life, your friends, and your hobbies to be truly successful?
Well, according to this specific model, if your goal is to be an absolute champion, the answer is a definitive yes. But look at the profound shift that occurs when you reach this stage. The ultimate goal of the five is to achieve a state of invulnerability.
What does that mean in practical terms?
When you make the methodology your entire lifestyle, you undergo a transformation. When you step into the ring or walk into a hostile boardroom, the opponent standing across from you is no longer actually fighting you, the flawed, insecure human being with emotions and fears.
Right.
They are fighting an optimized, perfectly calibrated technology that you have strategically placed between yourself and the world. Human beings get tired, they get emotional, they take insults personally, and they make mistakes. But a fighting machine operating as pure technology does not.
So when an aggressive negotiator tries to trigger your temper, they hit a brick wall.
Exactly. They are trying to fight human emotions, but you are just running an algorithmic response. You don't get angry. You just calmly execute the next optimal move. You become invulnerable because they cannot bypass the technology to hurt the person behind it.
Okay. Let's take a breath and recap the sheer magnitude of what we've unpacked with 2 + 3 = 5. To reach the absolute peak of human performance, you need the two, the grueling, ego-breaking duel where you surrender absolute authority to a scientifically minded mentor who practices what they preach.
Then you add a 3, The relentless, tightly controlled machinery of the coach assistant boxer triad that forces your pure will to conquer your human desires.
And finally, you combine them to activate the five, the all-consuming independent dedication to eradicate your psychological vices and make the entire system your permanent lifestyle.
And we must remind you of the most punishing principle of all of this: results are never enough.
Well, right.
The very moment you complete the cycle, win the championship, or close the massive deal, the system demands that you refuse to celebrate. You must immediately set a new, higher benchmark, reset your psychology back to zero, and start the grueling cycle all over again.
There is no final resting place at the top of the mountain. You're either climbing or you are falling.
Exactly.
Which brings us to a final, frankly, chilling thought from the methodology for you to mull over as you go about your day.
Yay.
We spend all this time talking about how hard the climb is, but there is a stark warning about the people standing around you right now.
Oh, the warning about the social circle.
Yes, your environment, your casual acquaintances, your old friends, and sometimes even your own family will actively try to pull you down into their group. Why? So that you don't outgrow them.
Right. They do not want to do the agonizing work of the climb, and your success makes them uncomfortable, so they try to anchor you to their level of mediocrity.
And the physics metaphor used to describe this dynamic is devastating. The text notes that the larger the mass, the higher the rate of acceleration when falling down.
Which means the more people you allow to attach themselves to you who do not share your absolute ruthless commitment to the technology of success, the faster and harder they will drag you down when gravity takes hold.
So ask yourself right now, look closely at your current social circle. Look at the people you text every day, the people you complain with, the people you spend your weekends with. Are they a safety net, actively supporting your climb up the mountain? Or are they a heavy, comforting mass that is actually accelerating your fall?
Yeah, it's a tough question.
It really is. Because if we go all the way back to our opening thought, that the secret to becoming a champion is realizing everything you know is wrong and you need to be completely broken down, you have to ask yourself a hard question today. Who might you need to cut out of your life right now just to make room for a mentor who will actually challenge you to a duel?